The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Bonjour, and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Pratosky, in Paris, the final show I'm recording in Paris, and the tech team in London, Jemima Kish.
Hi.
Charles Arthur.
Well, hello.
Alex Hearn.
Hello.
Well done, guys. This week on the show,
we have the problem that politicians are much, they find it much easier to locate harms when it comes to technological advancements than they're able to think about protecting the good.
Government appears to be moving backwards with regards to online censorship. There is some progress in the opposite direction in the UK. Jim Killick from the Open Rights Group gives us an update on imminent changes to UK copyright laws that will secure consumers' rights to parody, to copy, and to mine digital content. We'll also tackle some of this week's big tech news stories, including a breakthrough for the gaming industry as the EU open up a key tax break, the demise of Last.fm, and the rise of Spotify, and Amazon's plans to introduce anticipatory shopping software. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's been a long 7-year battle, but after a few tactical wins and a whole bunch of rhetoric, the UK's video games industry has been rewarded with tax breaks. Joining us down the line to explain what this means for the most maligned of the UK's creative industries is The Guardian's games editor, Keith Stewart. Keith, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Alex.
Keith, I understand you're jet-lagged. Have you been on the west coast of America for some reason?
I have, yeah. I was at the Call of Duty World Championships in Los Angeles for the weekend, which was really exciting and revealing about game playing. I think I've realized how bad I am at Call of Duty now.
I think you can accept that you're not going to go pro. Perhaps your time has passed, Keith. Perhaps your time has passed. Now let's dive into the details of these tax breaks. Long expected, long fought for. What are the details?
It has been a long fought for thing. It was, it's been since the kind of early 2000s that this has been coming up. And in 2010, it looked as though Labour were going to put this into effect. But then obviously they lost the election and the Conservatives kind of demurred on the idea of tax credits and announced that the tax credit plans were unfocused. So there was a big turnaround after that, and finally they've gone through. They've been approved by the EU Commission, which was originally suspicious about the whole concept, even though France's games industry has had a kind of tax credit in place for a while. There were some worries about this, what this would mean for the free movement of trade and everything within the EU. So, but that's all done, and they are live now. So from April the 1st, British game developers are going to be able to apply for tax breaks on expenditure on UK-based games.
So tell me a little bit more about the details of what's actually going into the tax breaks. Can they just ask for 20% tax relief on anything and everything, or does it have to be for research and development? What are the stipulations? What breaks are they actually getting?
In very basic terms, they can claim back up to 25% of 80% of the total costs of game production. So this will have to be based around a set of criteria and a cultural test. So you have to have at least 25% of your expenditure happening within the UK to be able to claim. And then your game has to comply with a series of tests. So, and you get points for certain key points on this test. So it's kind of like it's kind of like an exam, really, on how British your game is. But this is only a part of it. The most important part is meeting the fundamental kind of economic criteria of developing 25% of your game within the UK. And this can apply to everything, design, development, post-production. There's a few things that aren't allowed. For example, you can't claim on, if you spend 3 years just drawing pictures, you can't claim that. You can't claim on really kind of conceptual stuff. It's very much the core production process. And you also can't claim, it seems, if your project gets canned by a publisher. So if you're working on something for a year and you spend a lot of money on it, if that publisher then cans it, which actually can happen, it happens quite a lot in the industry, then you cannot claim tax credits on that. At least that's what it looks like at the moment. So basically, yes, you can claim 25% of 80% of the total production, and that's whether your game makes a profit or if it doesn't. If it makes a profit, you can claim tax credits back on that basis. But if it doesn't make money, then you can claim a cash rebate from HMRC.
Now, describe a little bit the industry, the trends in the development and publishing industry over the last, I don't know, over the last period of time that we've been debating tax breaks. You mentioned, for example, the publishing. If a publisher decides to can your game, that could be a publisher from anywhere in the world, and is probably quite likely because now there aren't any British publishers, are there?
No, there aren't. I mean, I suppose the closest we get is Codemasters, but which is the sort of racing game specialist based in near Leamington. But they don't globally publish their own games. So no, we don't have publishers here. I think what we've seen over the last 5 years is, a shift in the power of games towards these great big megalithic, usually US-based publishing houses like Activision and EA, both of which have closed studios in Britain over the last 5 years. They say it's because it's incredibly expensive to make games in the UK. Our salary costs are high. And they don't get the tax breaks, the tax incentives that are offered in other countries. If we look across, if we look across the Atlantic to Canada, in Quebec, the government there is able to offer tax credits covering up to 37.5% of video game staff costs. And this has seen lots and lots and lots of studios moving into places like Montreal. And in Montreal alone, you have Warner have got a place there. Ubisoft have got a studio there. Square Enix have a studio there. A lot of these companies have actually closed studios in Britain and moved them over there. And what we're also seeing is a significant brain drain as well. Lots and lots of staff have ended up qualifying in Britain as game developers and moving across to Canada. In fact, my brother-in-law Nick Harper got a job in Ubisoft in Montreal, and shifted the whole family over there for 5 years. So it's had kind of a personal impact on me, I've seen it happening personally. So yeah, and I think what the hope is with these tax credits is it will prevent that brain drain, but it will also inspire the bigger publishers to start investing in Britain again and opening studios, because if there's less of a risk for them, then there's more of an impetus for them to kind of exploit the amazing talent. And we do have amazing development talent in this country. It's just that the economic setup wasn't favorable to outside investors bringing in their investment.
That was Keith Stewart, our games editor. Now, obviously, there are a lot of things that he raised in that interview. And Jemima, I suppose the first question that I have for you is, and I know you're interested in this already, is this idea of what a culturally British game is. What do you think that means?
I think it's a very clever way of giving themselves absolute discretion over whatever game they decide to give a tax break to. It's just so vague.
They actually have a sort of heavily specified test. It's a points-based system. You need to get 16 points in the cultural test to qualify as culturally British. You get points for where the game is set, ranging from 1 point if at least a quarter of the game is set in the UK or another EEA state, up to 4 points if at least three quarters of it is. One thing that runs throughout it is this sleight of hand where, although they keep describing it as culturally British, it seems that they're not legally really allowed to focus just on England, so a lot of it is actually culturally European. Similarly, it has to depict, if it's got characters, they have to be British or European. If it's got points, if it's got a story, the story has to relate to Britain or Europe. But then you start running into, the difficulty with more conceptual games. What culture is Tetris at all? So you then also get points for composers, for artists, for designers, for heads of department.
I mean, when this was suggested a few years ago, because, this thing about we should get tax breaks for British games, I wondered if we'd have Grand Theft Auto, Western Supermare and stuff. I mean, what is it?
I would never say that this is a bad thing, because obviously anything that supports British business and this perfect mix that games is of technical technical ability and creative skill is a good thing. But that's entirely the point. Surely any game that supports British business and creative skill is a good thing. And it's limiting their creativity by putting down these stipulations about what can be in the story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and it's limiting the sort of games which can be involved, because they have a cap of 8 points which can be awarded based on who makes the game, and another 3 or 4 points on who sort of does work outside of the studio on the game. But as Keith said, if you're a small studio, you won't have enough people to garner those points. And if you're making something which is abstract or, you know, doesn't have a story or characters, you're not going to be able to be culturally anything, and you're going to run into these problems. So we're essentially, as it stands, funding the production of AAA video games, you know, the likes of Halo or Dragon Age Origins.
So Tearaway, which just won 3 BAFTAs and represents a small cutout paper man running around in different creatable worlds. Is creatable a word? I don't know. Which is a brilliant example of a UK gaming success, would not be eligible.
Maybe. It depends if he goes, oh, blimey!
Charles, you raise an interesting point, actually. GTA is developed by Rockstar, which is north of the border, of course. And as we all know, the 18th of September, there's a referendum. So what happens if, after the 18th of September, Scotland decides that it's going to devolve completely and be a separate country? Will that then be eligible for UK tax breaks? I'm assuming not. So GTA West and Supermare is just a fantasy in your mind. It's never going to happen, Charles. It's never going to happen.
They wouldn't be doing GTA West and Supermare. They'd be making GTA Glasgow. But of course, I suppose it would all depend on whether the... If it were to happen that Scotland were to vote for independence, and if Rockstar was to stay there, I suppose it would come down to whether the Scottish government would think it was worth giving them tax breaks in order to encourage them to stay there, which I suspect they might. So, you know, I suspect that Rockstar is going to probably stay where they are, because they'd have a fairly good lever with the Scottish government, whatever happened.
I'm looking forward to seeing the UK... the British citizenship test for each computer game that is put up in front of this, in front of these tax breaks. What happens when your game spills a pint on somebody else, that kind of thing. Anyway, you can follow this as it unfolds at theguardian.com/games. Last.fm, one of the great British tech startups, is apparently losing pace against its international rivals like Spotify, Charles, you reported in The Guardian this week. The streaming music discovery service announced that it will be discontinuing one of its main money-spinning opportunities, i.e. subscription radio, and will no longer stream to mobile phones. Charles, what's the story here?
So the thing is that Last.fm has really not managed to get any traction internationally, it seems. It's been going up against people like Spotify, like Pandora, even though it's substantially older than Spotify, certainly about the same sort of age as Pandora. Pandora is gigantic in the United States, but doesn't really look to go anywhere beyond those borders. Spotify started in Europe, started in Sweden, and having conquered Europe, sort of, it has been making good ground in the United States, and there's even rumors that it might be looking at filing for a stock market flotation. Last.fm, though, has been the sort of poor sibling in all of this, and it was bought by CBS some years ago, but CBS, being a sort of media company based in the States, hasn't really had much idea what it wanted to do with this streaming company based in the UK. So it's just not managed to garner the subscribers, which I think is a pity. I mean, personally, I have a Last.fm account. I do subscribe to its streaming account. It costs only £3 a month, which I think is great, but it's only going to be lasting for another month. It cuts off at the end of April. And they're going to be focusing instead on scrobbling, which is telling you what music you've been listening to, which I have to say, I sort of know what music I've been listening to. Why do you want to tell me that?
Well, tell me a little bit about scrobbling, the technology. Is this something that they can exploit, given that they're no longer going to be getting an income from subscription?
Well, it's a recommendation system. So the idea behind it is that you look at what music you've been listening to, and based on that and based on what other people listen to, and you try to find intersections and suggest, well, you listened to The Dead Weather, so you might like The Kills, for example. It sort of runs like that. It's trying to make associations between bands which might be similar, or artists who might be similar, and basically to try to monetize that. The trouble is, it's a... it's an idea which has been around for a long time. They were one of the first to implement it. But can you make much money off the back of it? That's really much more difficult.
I think this is a real tragedy, really, because at the time in 2007 when this company was bought by CBS, it was a big statement by CBS, but it was also a big kind of UK victory. If this isn't too mean, this is almost the musical equivalent of MySpace being bought by a big media company and then sort of flailing because they weren't given enough resource and enough innovation, and they've just sort of faded away. And obviously Spotify has completely eaten their lunch. But the technology at the root of this couldn't be more relevant. Scrobbling was started by Richard Jones, who actually at the time was a Southampton University student, and then the Guardian can take a very small amount of credit for this because we wrote about his technology, and Felix Miller and Martin Stixell read about this technology on The Guardian and then got in touch with him, so that he and they joined up and they became Last FM. So there's a rather lovely story there, but this is effectively a kind of big data story before big data became a thing. It's just really sad. I'm just quite sad about it.
But Charles, when it comes to the actual details of how they're losing money, it's not just because, well, for arguably Spotify did a very, very good thing when it signed a deal with Facebook to become a partner in Facebook, when suddenly, you know, you could sign up for Spotify through Facebook, and you know, it became a massive, massive household name, certainly through that partnership, whereas Last.fm didn't. Now they've been trying to keep themselves afloat, but they've been losing money. And how have they been losing money if they've arguably provided a free service for such a long time?
Well, that's part of the problem. It costs money to stream music. There is a fixed fee per stream, which is payable to the owners of the copyright and the music. And this is something which all the streaming music companies face. It's a sort of a drag, essentially, on their ability to grow because the amount that you pay per stream never varies. You don't sort of get to scale where suddenly it becomes much cheaper to stream, you know, 1,000 streams rather than 10, in the way that it does, for example, if you're running a just a plain website, where once you've bought your web server connections or whatever, then it becomes much more efficient to serve 1,000 people than it does to serve 10. So this is the problem all the music companies face, is that it's too expensive for them to charge money. And for Last.fm, I mean, I don't know how much money they were making off £3 a month. I think it was basically to try to get more subscribers. But yeah, the accounts filed to the end of 2012 showed it was made a pre-tax loss of £4 million in that year, with revenues which had fallen by 21%. And of that, subscription revenue had fallen by 12%. I have to say, Last.fm is not vanishing from the face of the planet. They'll still have their player, which is something on the website which you'll be able to play music, which in effect is routed through Spotify or through YouTube, and they'll monitor it for scrobbling purposes so that you can get the idea and recommendations for things. And they'll also have an iPhone app which will be able to stream music again through Spotify or YouTube and do the same. But it's not quite as satisfactory as the system they used to have for Android devices as well, and for Sonos devices, where you could just hook straight up to Last.fm, start streaming, and away you go.
So it will exist, Charles, but perhaps not in a format that we are familiar with today.
I think that, if I'm really honest, I think that it's a great technology, but it's just not hit the right level of users. And that's always a big problem for a company which relies on getting its money from users.
And the irony is that Last.fm were always very, very good at discovery, and Spotify have not been very good at discovery. And actually, perhaps the two of them should just have, you know, got together a bit earlier.
Yes.
Well, you can discover more at theguardian.com/technology. Here's the pitch. Imagine Minority Report, but lose the crime angle and instead insert shopping. Yes, shopping. Amazon has patented software known as anticipatory shopping. Now, before we dive in, I want to remind our listeners that last year we interviewed Darius Kazemi, the technologist who created the Amazon Random Shopper, an algorithm that delivered stuff to him based on what Amazon recommended. He had no idea what was going to arrive, but arrive it did. And most of the time, he was delighted. Sounds pretty similar, no? Well, before you go thinking that stuff you never ordered is going to arrive at your door before you even realize you want it, here are the not-so-sexy details. The patent, which was filed in January, describes a technology that optimizes the delivery service, predicting what people will want so that they can get stuff closer to them so it can be delivered faster than ever before. Wake up, people. Alex, what on earth is this?
I mean, it's basically taking the old concept of just-in-time logistics one step further, and it's before in time. Just-in-time is this idea which began, I think, in the 90s in Japanese car manufacture, where you dispense with warehouses. You don't bother making loads of wheels, keeping them in a big pile, and then picking the wheels up and putting them on cars. You ensure that you make four wheels at about the same speed as you make one car. Four wheels arrive in the factory, get put on the car drives off, the next four wheels come in, they get put on the next car, and so on and so on and so on and so on. That, thanks to companies like Amazon and also Apple, has been applied to the very consumer end of it. If you buy an iPhone from Apple, it gets shipped to you straight from the factory. Again, they don't bother warehousing. They just, their factories in China wait for orders, and then we'll post it straight from the factory, straight to your door. But the problem with that is you can't post an iPhone from China to the UK until you have an order in UK that you're going to fulfill. Amazon's idea is essentially, if you assume that Amazon's central warehouse sends out 500 widgets every month across the whole United States, and it sends around 200 of them to New York and 300 of them to the West Coast, it will start just shipping the 200 to New York, and then hopefully it will get ever and ever more niche until it ends up going, oh, well, you know, we normally get about one widget delivered to this postcode about once a week. We haven't had that order yet, but let's just ship it to that postcode. And then the last mile of delivery can wait until your order is put in. But that could potentially reduce the delivery time from days to hours or even minutes.
Exactly, because they're really starting to push this idea of same day delivery. Now, Charles, will this kill everybody else if Amazon gets this right?
Amazon is not as big as people sometimes think. It's very big in the States. It gets about half its revenue in the States. But the idea that it sort of is wholesale destroying everyone. I mean, online commerce is doing a lot of stuff, but it's very easy to overestimate. And it's a sort of category error, I think, that people tend to make, which is sort of, you know, a company announces something like this and everyone thinks, oh, my God, that's just going to completely destroy everyone within 6 months. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't sort of happen that way. So I think it would be a nice to have, but it's not actually going to be quite as dramatic as we expect.
Even if it's a same day delivery option, instead of, say, leaving my house, I can sit in my pajamas and click deliver to me now, and that means that I can get, I don't know, an MP3 player in the same amount of time as a pizza.
We seem to have gone over this with the drones thing, didn't we, where we had the issue of, well, what if you're in your third floor flat and things like that. I just think that the mechanics of same day delivery and the hassles involved tend to mean that it sounds great, doing it is hard. I mean, yeah, Amazon is a great is great at doing logistics, but it's one of those things where there's all sorts of unintended consequences, I suspect.
I think the more important fight that this affects is the one between Amazon and other faceless multinational retailers, companies like Walmart. Walmart's strategy for fighting Amazon is very heavily based around the fact that Walmart has stores all over America. They are really going big on the local delivery, on the same day delivery. Amazon might not be able to fight, you know, the small corner shop, you know, all of the places that people already use instead of Amazon because they don't like the facelessness of Amazon. But it is something where it can eat away at the advantages of supermarkets, at the advantages of the megastore based down the road. And, I mean, I'm not sure who I'd put money on in Walmart versus Amazon.
Jemima, this is a clever piece of predictive software because ultimately it's using big data for an interesting logistical issue. And this week in Eon magazine, author Tom Chatfield wrote about the ethics of delegating this kind of stuff to machines. And he wrote, and I'll quote here, "For the moment, machines able to think in anything approaching a human sense remain science fiction. How we should prepare for their potential emergence, however, is a deeply unsettling question, not least because intelligent machines seem considerably more achievable than any consensus around their programming or consequences." Would you say, Jemima, that Amazon's anticipatory shopping is one such intelligent machine?
Well, in a very rudimentary way, I suppose. This idea of singularity has been a sort of a sci-fi topic of discussion for quite a long time, and obviously it feels like it's kind of edging closer. As far as Amazon's concerned, I wouldn't be particularly worried about them. Their goal is to make as much money as possible, and I don't think that kind of taking over the world with smart self-thinking robots is their priority. So I don't think you can entirely blame Amazon for that one. But I think there will be lots of people asking if there need to be codes of ethics around how this kind of technology is implemented, whether certain kind of services shouldn't have intelligent machines working for them. I don't think that will happen because, as we know with technology and the internet, they will route round any obstacles or blocks. The government, of course, won't be able to keep up with what's happening. And so it will be left to people in the industry who are well informed and who understand the technology to scrutinise it and to make sure that it's that we are prepared for it and that it is rolled out in an ethical way. But it's an incredibly complex issue. So, yeah, watch this space.
We'll be in the bunkers while you watch this story unfold at theguardian.com/technology. As we are recording this on April 1st, it seems like a perfect time to discuss the freedom to joke. And one of the richest themes of contemporary comic culture is the use of movie and music clips to create parodies. For example, Hitler's bunker scene in the film Downfall, which has spawned countless ridiculous remakes. But under UK copyright law, this comic meme has been illegal. This week, there was a shift in thinking at the government level about online remix and mashup culture. Parliament has passed proposed laws. In fact, they've published proposed laws to change copyright regulation, a long battle for many. And I'm currently joined down the line by one person who's been on the front line of this campaign. It's Jim Killick, executive director of the Open Rights Group, which is an organization that's been fighting for change in this area. Thank you very much for joining us, Jim. Now, you posted the news on your site this week outlining the imminent changes to the UK copyright law. Can you tell us more?
So, yeah, actually, the government has been trying to look at copyright law and seeing whether it's out of date and whether it needs reform since at least 2006. And it has run through two reviews, the Gowers review in 2006 and this current government did its own review in 2010, the Hargreaves review. And both came to broadly similar conclusions. That's to say that copyright, as it is in the UK at the moment, is too restrictive. It bans format shifting, that's to say copying music onto your iPod. It doesn't allow data mining. It's restrictive for academic institutions. And for us, critically, it also doesn't allow campaigners and comedians to comment directly on copyright work through parody. So we've been asking for this change to be made because we've seen countless parodies on YouTube just being pulled because copyright owners have complained, and the result has been that things like Greenpeace campaign videos have just been removed and at the height of campaigns, as well as things like parodies of the Olympics. During the Olympics, there were parodies around that which got pulled because of copyright claims, and they pretty much disappeared. And we see legal threats every few months along these lines. The latest was from Transport for London complaining about campaigners spoofing their posters. So, you know, it's really important for campaigners as well as comedians. It's quite a perilous thing to parody a copyright work of somebody with a big legal budget. So we think it should be made simpler to defend.
Now, you've outlined the top lines from both the Gowers review and the Hargreaves review, which, as you say, were government-initiated reviews of copyright law in the digital age. But what now are the proposed changes to the copyright law that were passed earlier this week?
Well, so they haven't yet passed. They've been published. And that, in fact, was a very, very big step because we've been being promised the final drafts that are going to be put before Parliament for months now. We were expecting them pretty much in the autumn. They didn't get published in the autumn. And the window of opportunity to publish these things and get them past this parliament has been narrowing and narrowing. This is maybe the one before last absolute possible chance they have to put these before parliament and have a vote. The things that have been put forward, they are legalizing your iPod, that's say format shifting, allowing you to transfer copies from one format or medium to another. They're the right to parody. There's a data mining exception for researchers, and there are improvements to the sorts of archival exceptions and education exceptions as well. So they're quite broad, and they're aimed at really improving economic use of copyright works. Particularly the data mining exception for researchers is aimed at allowing academic institutions to search through ebooks and publications that they've legally purchased and subscribed to be able to sort of see what research is out there and see what kinds of thinking has already been done, you know, in order to improve things like medical research. So it's extremely important exceptions for future economic activity.
Indeed, and it's unsurprising, of course, that there is an economic element to the impetus behind this, because I can't imagine them doing this simply out of the good of their hearts. There are this is a very, very fierce battle that's been going on.
Yeah.
But in terms of format shifting and data mining and parody, I want to get into the economic issues in just a moment. But what are the boundaries according to the newly published laws? Because I'm sure that, you know, there will be gray areas at the edges. What are those things that are now legal, and what are those things that would not be legal if these were passed?
Well, the grey areas is interesting. I mean, the format shifting is definitely a private use kind of exception. So I think it will still restrict companies from providing you with copies, for instance. If you have upload to a service on the cloud, which is perhaps just noting that you have access to a copy rather than storing all of your files, I think, and then perhaps giving you information about your music and helping you sort it and so on, I think that would probably not have the format shifting applied. I think they'd be very careful to exclude those kinds of services so it's very clear that the music industry is able to get revenues from some of those sorts of service. I think also with the parody, it's very clear that it's quite narrowly defined. It's defined as something called fair dealing, which means that if you use very large amounts of the original work, if you're using it for commercial purposes, and if you're trying to do it when actually a license would be available to you, then those sorts of things would not fall under the exception. So we're going to have to see how case law pans out with that, and I think it's very important that we start to use case law to build up and protect that right. And of course, if the courts don't extend it enough and we find that things are being stopped which really shouldn't be, then we should argue to extend the exception further in the future. But the first thing is to just see how it works in the courts. And I think one of the unfortunate things about copyright is it always is defined, the edges are defined by courts. It's very hard for laws to be completely certain in these areas. So even though we have these new rights, it is without a doubt going to be a certain amount of legal action that actually defines the edges in the end.
You mentioned that this is legalizing practices that are already in place, you know, things like parody, things like format shifting, and to a degree data mining, perhaps not in as many of the different avenues as this opens up that this affords. But again, this is not because the government has suddenly realized that this is the zeitgeist. What is it economically that they realize that they can benefit from these three particular elements of UK copyright law? How can they benefit economically from shifting this?
Well, I think with format shifting, it simply makes it clearer what the technologies are allowed to do. And that certainly allows marketing to be easier. There's a Cambridge manufacturer called Brennan who have a device which copies CDs for people onto a hard drive, turns them into MP3s, and they have to advertise on their site that copying CDs without permission of the rights holders is illegal. And that's a very confusing message for consumers. So things like that will get cleared up. They will be much easier. Secondly, I think with parody, I think it will be, I think mostly it is a human rights benefit. You know, it's a free speech benefit. But arguably there are plenty of comedians who are starting their careers doing these kinds of mashups, and you know, they will have greater legal certainty. So arguably it will be easier for the next generation of British comedians who do work online to experiment in ways currently fairly dodgy legally. I'll just have a bit more certainty about doing that.
Finally, Jim, and briefly, how fit for purpose would you say the structure of lawmaking is to respond to technology changes? Can they actually ever keep up?
You know, I think really it isn't great. I mean, copyright is a particular problem because it's very, very, potentially very rigid. Legal uses are written in as these exceptions once every few years, and in fact there's currently a set menu in Europe of what's allowed. So it means going back to have a debate in Europe about how we have more flexibility as new technological uses of works emerge. In other arenas, I think we have the problem that politicians are currently much easier to locate harms when it comes to technological advancements than they're able to think about protecting the good. And that's something they're really going to have to think about hard, because at the moment they're not really creating incentives for technology to improve in and of itself. They're mostly just finding things to complain about, and they're over-promising how much they can help those problems, which are usually social problems, things like children accessing pornography or terrorism. You know, they try to answer some of those questions through restrictions on technology, and I just don't think that's actually a very appropriate way to approach these problems. Usually what you have to do is get to the root, and technology has very little to do with the root problems that they're trying to deal with.
Jim, thank you so much. It's an absolute pleasure to speak again.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week. Thank you to our London team and to Jim Killick from Org. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps and presented by me, Alex Kratofsky. We're back next week on Wednesday. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.